welcome once again to another exciting episode of Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Sunday, July 9th. No, not July. This is 3 weeks in a row I've messed up the dates in some way or another.
I don't know. For 2 weeks this month, I thought it was September.
Well, that's okay, what I'm talking about. It was actually you who messed up the last couple weeks. It's me this time.
Well, yeah.
Right. Although, 2 weeks ago, I suggested that maybe it was 2001, and then you thought it was September. And then 1 week ago, you thought it was the wrong day of the week, or two weeks ago. I don't know. It's June 19th, 2011. I'm Sam Minter, and this is, of course, Yvonne Bo with me. So,
hello.
Yep. Hey, Yvonne. We have an exciting show coming up to talk to you. Sort of the first topic on the list is going to be talking about a little bit about Libya, the Obama's reaction to the war powers stuff, and just I think in general, presidential power. Then we'll move on to other topics. We have some thoughts on IBM hitting their 100th anniversary, Research in Motion not hitting their 100th anniversary quite yet and looking like they might not ever. There's an interesting thing I saw about the New York Post this morning. And finally, a little bit about the economy, inflation, housing market, stuff like that. That's the plan anyway. Let's see how it actually goes. Yep. So let's start out. One of the things that happened, and we've talked about this on the show a few times, but a couple weeks ago, we passed the 60-day limit that the War Powers Resolution Act, whatever you want to call it, gives a president who has, in an emergency situation, deployed troops to hostile action or, deployed American armed forces to hostile action, I should say. The act is structured so that it says basically, normally the president should come to the Congress for either a declaration of war or an explicit authorization for the use of force, but that in emergency circumstances, the president is allowed to do what he thinks is necessary, but then must come for that authorization within 60 days. A few weeks ago, we passed that 60-day boundary. Obama presented nothing to the Congress. This last week, he released a statement, essentially, giving the justifications for why he did not think that was necessary. And basically, it boils down to saying, we haven't been engaged in quote-unquote hostilities in Libya since we turned the operation over to NATO a month or more ago. And therefore, there's no requirement under the act to report because we're just supplying support or something like that. And that doesn't count. And apparently just, drone attacks in general don't count. Part of the argument was, we're not in a situation where our forces can actually be fired upon. Which brings up the interesting issue. Does that mean as long as you're just using missiles and drones, you're never in a hostile situation? You're only in a hostile situation if, American armed forces are physically in danger themselves. So, as long as you're going after somebody who's much weaker, you're never in a hostile situation. I don't know. But anyway, he has gotten a lot of criticism for this, and it got more so within the last few days when the news came out that basically to arrive at this justification, Obama actually overruled most of the top lawyers in his administration who said you really should go and the War Powers Act does apply here. The Attorney General and the Office of the Legal Counsel both recommended that the War Powers Act was in play here. And Obama apparently went instead with the advice of some lower-level lawyers, one at the State Department, and I forget where the other one was, to go with this opinion instead. So that's the basic outline of the whole thing. We'll get more into it, but first, Yvonne, what's your take on this whole thing?
Well, I feel very uncomfortable about this whole thing, especially because I think that you and I are on the same page of the fact that over the last, throughout history, but, I think especially, I will say over the last 20 years, 20 or 30, I mean, you've seen this presidential continuance of just, taking powers that Congress should have and seeing Congress do very little or nothing in order to ascertain its powers.
Well, yeah, Congress basically lies down and says, you know, I want to say they lie down and take it, but it's not even really that. They don't want this power. It's not that they're, you know, for whatever reason, being scared of fighting for their power. They actively don't want it. They don't want to have to make these decisions.
Right. And, you know, this is just ridiculous. I mean, I don't agree with this. I don't agree that Congress should abdicate its responsibility to have oversight over many areas of presidential power, and this is one of them. And if the president cannot present a compelling case for us to be in a situation as we are, then, you know, we're going to have to withdraw our troops. And it's as simple as that. And I he has not done so.
Well, there have been there was an effort actually in the House of Representatives to pass a resolution that basically forced the president's hand on this. And it was very interesting because there was a resolution introduced by Dennis Kucinich, of all people, that mm-hmm. was going to basically say, you know, the president is in violation of the War Powers Resolution. All troops must be, you know, we must cease this action immediately, or something along those lines. And then all of a sudden, yeah, and no one was really worried about this because, I mean, this is Dennis Kucinich. He files all kinds of goofy laws all the time, and they never go anywhere. Then all of a sudden, somebody realized that most of the Republicans were going to a significant enough portion of the Republicans were going to vote for this, along with a significant enough portion of the Democrats, that this thing was on the way to winning. You know, and people were like, oh, wow, where'd this come from? And this took the Republican leadership off guard because they, you know, the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership are, for the most part, united in supporting the president and his actions and not, like, pushing on this issue. But realizing that this was happening, the Republican leadership offered an alternative resolution, which basically said the same, sort of protested the same thing, but took sort of the legal teeth away from it. That would try to actually force the president to do something. And then that one ended up passing instead. And I'm not sure where if anywhere, it went in the Senate. But anyway, so the Congress actually started to do something, and I was, like, surprised. But, you know, it's a... But it in the end, it's not getting pushed. You know, Obama's not pulling out. You know, I've been looking at this, and, look... This kind of stuff really pisses me off because it's sort of like, it seems like so clearly a violation of the original intent of separation of powers. And I completely realize how that has evolved over time, and there have been precedents and things have gone to court and sort of ratified the precedents that have happened on occasion. And so, you know, what we have today is very, very different, but it seems so clearly to violate, you know, look, I'll tell you one other thing that is influencing me to some degree on this, although for the most part it's ratifying the views I was always already thinking. The book I'm actually reading right now, and I'll recommend it to people who are concerned about this kind of issue or want some history on it, is The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power by Gene Healy. It's actually written from the perspective of, you know, basically what Yvonne and I have been talking about right here, which is that the amount of power being concentrated in the executive is way too high, and Congress has been neglecting its duty, et cetera. So come into it knowing that it's from that perspective. It's actually from somebody who's affiliated with the Cato Institute, so it's got that sort of, you know, founders, libertarianish type spin to it, too. But it's a good historical overview, and one of the things is, like, you know, you mentioned for the last couple decades, but going on even further, you know, the modern version of this seems to trace back to, like, President Wilson or something. You know, this has been going on 100 years at least, and it's a ratcheting effect where every single president, regardless of party, with the exception of one or two in the early part of the century, very actively acted to pull more powers in and not give any powers back. And, you know, And reading this, I go through this and I'm like, you know, there's not a single president since like FDR or Wilson or somebody who probably shouldn't have been impeached, you know, including Obama, yeah. You know, for this kind of crap, you know, forget like Clinton and his little Lewinsky affair, you know,
right.
Clinton also put in troops in violation of the War Powers Resolution, into, Bosnia.
Bosnia.
You know? And it's arguable that, you know, George H.W. Bush in
Somalia.
And Panama, you know, and there's just,
and Panama.
There's just tons of these. And, you know, I look at this and I get so, like, disgusted. I'm like, ah! But, you know, that's the direction it's been pushing. And I remember us talking specifically about this towards the end of the last election campaign. And also between the election and Obama's inauguration. And I remember saying specifically things along the lines of, you know, it's all well and good to talk about the limits of presidential power when you're not the president. But once you're the president, then you want to get things done. And you're like, well, it's all very nice that there are checks and balances. And if somebody who didn't know what they were doing or who was a bad person was here, then that I'd be in favor of that check and balance. But hey, I'm a good guy and I know what I'm doing, so therefore I should have the power. And so no sitting president in living memory has rejected presidential power and said, no, you know, I would like to do something about that, but I can't. Congress has to do
right.
something. I mean, you know, at least not on anything around the edges. There are things that are still sort of so widely accepted, you know, Congress has to do it. Like, I think when it has happened, it's been more an excuse. Like, you know, like Obama has said something along those lines in, with regard to gay marriage and with regard to gays in the military and don't ask, don't tell and stuff. Oh, sorry, I can't do anything. There's a law. I have to wait for Congress to go first. But at the same time, oh, no problem going into Libya, you know. So it's right. not—it's not like a consistent thing there. I don't know. Very, very frustrating. And even more frustrating than the fact that it's happening is the fact that you know nobody's going to do jack shit about it. And so it just ratchets further. And there's so and there's evidence, you know, like the Obama administration has not only done this with war powers, they've continued a lot of the Bush administration things in terms of being able to hold prisoners without trial and all of this kind of stuff. And I don't know. It makes me very upset the more I think about it. Just, you know, because, look, the fundamental thing, and this is the genius of, to me, The main insight that is worth, like, taking seriously about how the American Constitution was originally set up. Now, I'm not with the people who, like, revere it as some sort of holy document. But the main insight that I think was extremely valuable is the whole thing is written from the perspective of not concentrating power and spreading power Correct. Around and making sure that no single person or no single group could push through their agenda and what they wanted to do, because they came from the perspective at the very beginning of, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts Yes. absolutely, and that there can be bad individuals that no matter what you do with the structure can get to the top. And even if you've got a good guy, they can make mistakes and Right. they can, you know, because they have all the power, they can get full of themselves and make even more mistakes and do bad things for the country. And so therefore, you need to make sure every single point in the process has veto points where other people can second guess that judgment and stop what's happening if what's happening isn't good. And so the whole document was full of these, you know, in terms of ways for the president to veto the Congress if the Congress was getting out of line. Ways for the Congress to override the president if the president was going out of line. Making sure that the president could nominate people to their office, but they had to be confirmed by the Senate. You know, making sure that, and they didn't explicitly outline the Supreme Court override, but that came very shortly thereafter. The Supreme Court asserted its own rights, so the Supreme Court could then override laws as well, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The whole structure is full of this kind of stuff. And I know for anybody who's sitting there trying to, you know, who thinks they have the right answer and who's trying to push it through, all of this stuff is incredibly frustrating because it means it's a lot harder to do anything. But that's kind of the point. You know, it's you have those checkpoints and slowdowns and whatever to make sure that what you end up doing really is something that you do have broad consensus for. Even then, you can fail. There's very often times where the broad consensus is stupid or wrong. But nevertheless, you know, it's a helpful piece of the process. And this is the part, this part of the system, which to me is like the core positive insight of the whole damn kit and caboodle, is has been eroded and eroded and eroded more for at least the last century. And you know, president after president has been claiming more power, and it's just very, very troublesome and worrisome. And I don't know.
All right, I get it. We all get it. I mean, it is a situation we are in. I mean, you know, look, there are certain things right now, for example, where you see that the Congress obviously is trying to exert its power on certain things. For example, things such as the budget, the debt ceiling, and some other stuff. But however, you know, the thing is that that this thing, especially in the situations which are involving foreign policy and especially major deployment of U.S. troops, they've just passed the buck on it. And I think that sometimes, many times, they're even more critical than others. I mean, let's face it, you know, our economy, one of the reasons we're in such hock right now is because of these kinds of deployments that have gone overseas without a fucking declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really permeates down to the rest of our society. And so if we don't take this seriously, then, you know, they're really advocating a lot of responsibility. So anyway.
Yeah, and the bottom line,
I think we already beat this.
Yeah, we beat the horse. I'll just say one more thing and then we'll go to break, which is, you know, everybody always advocates, or not everybody, but lots of people are just fine and dandy and okay when their guy is the one holding all the power.
Right.
But you gotta remember, it's not always gonna be your guy. You have to have a structure in place that you're
happy.
Just
voted
as happy
for this
with
guy,
as the
and
guy.
Like I said, I voted for this guy and I don't like it.
Your opinion on what the president should or should not be able to do should not change depending on if
because
it's Barack Obama
president.
Or John McCain.
Yeah,
or fucking Sarah
yes.
Palin, for that matter. You want all this power in the hands of Sarah Palin? You know, I don't know.
Whoever. No, right. I don't want all this kind of power in anybody who's president. Period.
Yep. Okay, let's go to break. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about light frothy things like IBM. Is IBM light and frothy?
Probably not.
Okay, we'll be right back.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And we're here. So
we're here.
IBM's about to hit an anniversary, 100 years old. Do I hear right?
Well, that's true. Now, one thing I noticed is that they said that yes, even though IBM does call this the 100th anniversary, it is really truly 126 years old. Okay,
I
was looking at this.
So
okay, it is actually
is 100 years when they incorporated gave the name or what's the
No. Because the name came about even a little bit later. First, it wasn't called that. Okay. Let me see. It was called something else at first. I can't remember exactly. But the bottom line is that it was incorporated as the Computing Tabulating Recording Company in 1911.
Catchy name.
Okay. Yeah, very catchy. And let's see. But it started in 1886 originally. Okay, when a guy called Herman Hollerith, statistician, started a business to rent out the tabulating machines that he had originally invented for the America Census. Okay, and so that's where it started. And actually, one of the first things that I found pretty interesting about this is that one of the first technology they used this is they created these punch cards, okay, that punched holes in tickets to denote the passenger's observable traits. Say, for example, that they were tall, female, whatever. So in order to prevent fraud from somebody else using another person's cards, okay, he developed a punch card that held a person's data and an electronic contraption to read it. So they would go take the tell you, oh, this is a 34-year-old female, like, you know, with dark hair. And if somebody showed up that didn't look like that, then you'd know that it wasn't. And that was like in the late 1880s. And then it was sometime about 20-plus years later after 1911 that they changed the name to International Business Machines because they found that the Computing Tabulating Recording Company name was a little bit too limiting. So now the thing about this is that you got to remember something. We're talking about a company that spent in the technology business over 100 years, basically gone and like survived very massive technological change, almost went belly up. Okay, mm-hmm. At some point,
and you'll notice that if they, if you check in on them like every 25 years or so, it looks like a very different company each time.
That's exactly right. I think that's the big thing about it. You know, you've got a company that has been able to over the years evolve their business model and continue to try to provide services or technology, whatever technology is, to the current customers. And they were showing a chart, of the stock market capitalization right now of IBM over the years. And, right now it is in the pack at the same value as, say, Google, Microsoft, a few others, showing some big spurts and falls. But actually, for example, if you look at in 2000, the tech bubble existed. I mean, Microsoft and Cisco were both worth around $600 billion. Okay, all right. Right now, they're only worth $200 billion. Okay, but let's face it. I mean, Apple's only worth a little bit over $300 billion right now, which is the number one tech company. But the fact that IBM was only worth about $200 billion then, and they're close to worth what they were at the peak of the tech boom. Okay. It's quite interesting, whereas the other companies have collapsed by like 65%. But I think the one thing that's just interesting, like you said before, is that IBM has evolved their technology, or what they do over the years significantly in order to survive the changes. And I guess the one thing that I was seeing in contrast to the frickin' shellacking and disaster that Research in Motion is suffering from right now. They really have fucked up. I mean, completely, like, major league fucked up. I mean, I haven't seen a fuck up like this in a long time. I'll tell you the one biggest thing where they have fucked up, okay? I don't know if you've noticed this, but I had, and somebody finally in an article wrote this. When do you think was the last time RIM launched a new major phone? I don't know.
A year and a half, something like that?
Well, almost. It'll be a year in August. Okay. In about a month. Okay? Now, given how technology and stuff has been moving like so quickly and how competitors have been like launching like new OSs, new changes, new this, new that, I mean, it's a fucking eternity, okay, right now. Especially given that people didn't think their phones were all that spritzy in the first place. So they've spent almost about a year without launching a new major phone.
Well,
they
don't I will say, you're right, almost a year, but like Apple's cycle is about one a year.
That is true. But here's the difference. Apple actually launches major operating system upgrades or updates as time goes along, even if they stick to one phone. Right. The other thing about the phone that I think you see about the phone, about the iPhone that evolves a lot differently than the others is that when you get an iPhone, I think every latest generation, it's quite a powerful phone. It has a lot of storage. It has a lot of this. It has a lot more than practically everybody else. So even like, say, you grab the current iPhone, top of the line, 32 gigs, right? Okay. I haven't seen a BlackBerry phone that has that much storage right now from any of the ones that you grab. Or I grab a Galaxy or grab the other. So I think that there is something around – they used to be last year. I think we talked about this. They were pushing a lot of cheap phones, okay? $99, whatever. And they weren't moving up the food chain to all these more expensive, sophisticated phones, like some of the Samsung Galaxies and some other stuff with the iPhone or this has been coming out, they've been dominating the market. So when you get them and all of a sudden they go into a fucking – you're a maker of cheap phones that basically 3 months from now, any other phone looks like much better than yours in like 3 months. Then you go into a complete stop. And a lot of the reason they've been saying is because they spent a lot of time developing the playbook, okay?
Right.
Now, let me tell you something. Shit. Why in the world would you suck all your resources to try to enter a market that you're not in to then launch a product in it that sucks? Which apparently has been
I presume they didn't go into it with the goal of let's make something that sucks.
But here's the thing. Even if it was the best one out there, even if it was, it wasn't going to come out until next summer, and you were neglecting your main fucking bread and butter business. I mean, you're just not even paying attention to it. You're letting that business just get killed. I mean, how the hell do you go doing that is what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of a sudden you turn around and all of a sudden, so you've got no new fucking phones, and then you've got nothing behind it. Okay, and then you've got and then the other product that you spend all your time developing sucks ass. I mean, they've been like, I mean, I was just reading that. I mean, a number of carriers because let's put it to you this way, AT&T wanted nothing to do with a goddamn thing. You know why?
Why?
The fucking tethering with the damn BlackBerry itself.
Right.
Because the only way to get data was to tether it. They didn't want to offer a tethering plan because AT&T has been against it. And say they were like, "Fuck you, we're not offering this damn thing." Okay. It started off with that. Then every other partner looked at it. Well. Then you've got this problem. So they did not really sell any of their fucking mobile phone partners on the damn device, okay? Then they made the device dependent on the damn phones.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, basically you're in a fucking catch-22 where even device availability is a problem. I'm just, like, baffled by this whole thing. You know, and actually, one of the things that their co-CEOs at BlackBerry kept saying, the reason why they delayed the launch was something about because we needed to make sure because I guess if you read it, this is what it seemed like to me. Well, we knew that the first version was going to suck, so therefore we needed to make sure we could update it over the air, and so that needed to be critical to be included. Mm-hmm. And I'm like thinking, so it took you 10 months to make sure you could fucking push software upgrades to a fucking goddamn tablet device? It took you 10 months to figure that out? Seriously? So, I don't know. You know, they're in trouble. I mean, they're just, you know, they're, and they just announced, I just saw one thing that's just a telling statistic. In 2009, BlackBerry had 50% of the market share of the smartphones in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're down to 17%. I mean, they've lost, 33 points in 2 years. Okay, I mean that's a shellacking. Okay, I mean that's just. I don't know.
Well, I heard one person. I think it was probably John Gruber. Describe sort of what happened here as, you know, they were in the messaging business of sort of you have a phone and you have a lot of you add messaging features to it, you know, email,
right,
messaging, etc. Sure. And they missed the transition to, you know, what you're really getting is a pocket computer, you know,
right,
that happens to have some messaging and some other things, but it's
correct.
You know, and
the messaging is de-emphasized, and you know, it's just the device becomes a computer. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
I just think that, well, it's just quite amazing how quickly they have just fallen off a cliff. Did you ever own a BlackBerry?
No, I never owned a BlackBerry. Before going iOS, before iOS existed, I was doing Trios.
Oh, that's right. You had the Trios. Okay, there you go.
I had a number of Trios, but
that's another bunch of people that went. Well, I mean, even though HP just launched a brand new WebOS phone that, together with a couple of partners, that actually I saw looked quite cool, to be honest with you. I don't know, you know, well, I think that they should be able to, if they keep, like, a good investment in it and keep hammering at it, they can get a good amount of market share. I just don't know if it's going to be any dominant market share. But I think that there is certainly room out there for more competitors in this space.
There certainly is.
And they have a device that gets, you know, quite a lot of kudos for ease of use and doing stuff. So maybe they get something, but... But right now, the way that RIM's looking, they're looking not good. Not good at all.
They're looking like they won't be around that much longer.
No, they're looking like a takeover target. To be honest with you, if somebody wants a couple of people would say that there may be like the crash of a couple of garbage trucks is to put together fucking, you know, maybe a Nokia and Research and Motion, maybe they could merge. I mean, they could figure out something, you know, using their, you know, do that. I don't know. But I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, when people...
That's where it is right now.
You know, that seems like the kind of thing where, you know, it wouldn't go anywhere. You know, I don't know. We'll see. I get more interested when people speculate on, like, you know, how Apple's going to spend their wads of cash if they ever decide to actually spend it.
They are building a flying saucer.
They are building a flying saucer. They are doing this whole iCloud thing that we talked about last week. But they've got enough money to, like, buy entire industries, you know. If they wanted.
It's getting close to that anyway.
You know, yeah, like, I saw someone saying, now, this would never happen, and there are all kinds of regulatory reasons and stuff, too, but they could buy, like, several of the U.S. phone carriers if they wanted to, in cash, you know? They could buy significant chunks of the entertainment industry if they wanted. You know, say, you know, your fucking record label's trying to screw us over, or you don't want your movies on iTunes. Fuck it, we'll buy you. You know,
fine. I mean, but I think that the one thing is that they have. I mean, a few people have speculated this, and I think that eventually it will happen for certain reasons. I mean, I would think that they would want to purchase maybe not one of the big wireless carriers, but somebody with a national footprint that they could that they could add, like, just, you know, data only services.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean,
it would have been nice if they did that a long time ago instead of their IBM, AT&T IBM. Stuff.
AT&T.
But right. You know, they
didn't have that kind of cash back then. So anyway.
And there are also kinds of logistical reasons. Just like I remember, we had this whole discussion about Google buying Spectrum. You know, I'm still pissed that Google didn't fucking buy the Spectrum and do something really interesting with it. But, you know, whatever.
You never know.
It's anyway, change, so any final words on IBM before we move on?
Well, I guess that, you know, this is just an example. I mean, tech companies come and go relatively, you know, quickly. I mean, we've had so many ones that went like rose and crashed and rose again. I mean, think about Apple. Think about Cisco. I mean, I think that. The main lesson from IBM is just that, you know, one of the reasons why you see companies like Dell, Nokia, and other stuff, or even BlackBerry, get into the trouble situation is that they start looking at their market or what they do too narrowly. Okay. Right. And they stop thinking about what the heck they're actually providing, and they start thinking only about what the hell they're making. Okay? Oh, so we make a phone that gets email, so we'll make the fastest and cheapest phones that get email. Well, if you're not looking at what the customer's buying, then you're just making something. All of a sudden, the customer interest moves, and you're making something maybe more efficiently and faster and cheaper than everybody else, but then nobody wants anymore.
Right.
So I guess that's the main lesson about this.
Now, IBM's like the oldest in the tech stuff. There are a number of number of other major companies that are 100 plus years old, right? I mean, or getting close.
Oh yeah, like New York Stock Exchange is 175 years old, for example. They're a company. Yeah, there's a number of companies that are older than that.
Well, no, I meant like of the big ones, like, you know, but then there are ones
General Electric.
Yeah, General Electric, of course, which was Thomas Edison's company, right?
Yes, yes. General Electric, however, is the only surviving company in its original form that isn't part of the Dow.
Right.
All others are not there anymore.
But and like even ones that you think, and this wasn't a Dow, but like even companies that you think of as really, really old, like AT&T, you forget what actually happened. AT&T died, and then its brand was rebought. So there's not a...
That's exactly right.
They broke the
current
company
history. Is not... That's correct. The AT&T that originally existed completely died. What exists right now is another company that took really its name and like attached it to it, which was an offspring of AT&T, but
yes.
As a continuous company, it does not is that company ceased to exist a while ago.
Yeah, so. Well, it's fun to look at sometimes you can Google this and get like the descendant chart of the original AT&T after the breakup and the hundreds of companies that have come out of that, and then how they've been reconsolidated.
Like Avaya, for example.
You know, so.
You've got Avayas, Verizons, and I mean, you know. All these other companies that exist, yeah.
If you want to go back even further, you can find charts of the same thing when they broke up U.S. Steel. Anyway, it's interesting
right.
stuff. Let's take a break. It's time for your poem of the week. Enjoy your poem, and we'll be right back talking about a few other things.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel.
It Took Us So Long to Get Here, by Albert Abanado. December 13th. I say we walk to my uncle's home in the Philippines, but I should really say to my father's old home. I suppose I could say the place my father was raised, except that doesn't account for all the concrete and aluminum replaced since then, the additional plumbing, the absent water buffalo. I could say where I no longer cross ditches, or where I once bathed in the rain, or where I watched a pig slaughtered for the first time. They gagged the pig with a large stick shoved down its throat before slitting its neck open, and afterwards children bounced a balloon made from its bladder against their knees and thighs. January 3rd. Which one is he again? Is a question I admit is probably not the most appropriate response when offered a position like best man at a wedding overseas. And when I consider the statement now, I should have refrained from asking right away before I spent some time figuring out if I really did forget about him like I suspect I did, or if he was just being elusive, but asking anyway was a kind of confession that didn't require forgiveness. A way to say without saying so that last year's trip to the Philippines felt like a stroll through a country full of shades, mostly full of sun and lightning and the taste of fresh shellfish. Besides, I needed to know if he had the voice that reminded me of my favorite sandwich, or the one with the very egg-like personality. I just hoped he wasn't the one who liked to talk with a mouthful of meat. When I dream of that one, all I see are teeth. January 9th. Once, because the walls of the remodeled home were so thin, the whole family listened to my grandmother's urine hitting the porcelain rim of the toilet. It wasn't a steady sound, but more of a trochee or iambic, depending on where you stood, and while we waited for the sound to dissolve, we thought about the music it resembled. If a famous singer like Lei Salonga could pull off a song to this beat, although we kept that part to ourselves. November 23rd. Despite the surprise I felt finding my grandfather's coffin in the living room, I thought the body looked good if we ignored the heat and the poor makeup job. Granted, they kept him sealed behind glass, so I couldn't get close enough to really inspect the body or hold his wrist, and I wanted to brush from his collar the stray patch of powder they used to color his cheeks, adjust the hue of his lips. But all things considered, at least he didn't smell, which makes me feel optimistic since I'll be sleeping in the room right across from him, and the last thing any of us wants is to sit down to our meals and be reminded of a body decomposing in the same room. I preferred to think of him as someone who got bored and passed out from watching the episode of Survivor that's taken 6 months to get to the Philippines, who prefers taking his naps behind thin glass with a vase full of flowers sitting on his chest, and because everything was so good, I didn't think about the gash in his head. It must have been like a little moon escaping his scalp when he slipped and fell in the bathroom, which according to one relative, would never have happened if he had been living in America.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
And here we are. And we were talking a little bit about the iOS versus RIM versus whatever. One of the themes that we've talked about before are like people trying to make publishing models work. We had the whole New York Times paywall that Yvonne and I talked about a bunch. And by the way, the update, it looks like, as far as I can tell, they did indeed lose a lot of audience, but they may have kept enough to make money.
I will tell you something. I have found ways around the stupid thing. Here's a simple thing. Okay, what the hell? I mean, I'm like, you know what? I just usually what I do, I'll go to New York Times, I'll start reading an article, and I'll hit stop loading before the page finishes loading, and I can read the article. The little pop-up screen that blocks the thing from not letting you read, it needs to have the whole page load so it shows up.
That's
so
lovely.
If I actually just I'm not fucking paying these assholes just because actually I'm not. You know I am not against paying, but I'm not paying them just for spite because they're assholes.
I understand. And apparently their print subscriptions actually like got a little bump out of this as well. But anyway, in general, and then you've got a bunch of magazines and newspapers trying to make like apps for their stuff instead of, going to their websites, because then you can pay for a subscription, blah, 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 blah. But then, you have a number of people, and Yvonne has made this comment before, where, in many cases, why bother with the app? If you've got your iPhone or iPad, just go to the real website. And half the time, right, they've got a mobile version anyway that's pretty good. And even if they don't have a mobile version, at this point, mobile browsers are pretty good with regular old web pages that are formatted for larger computers. They work just fine. So the New York Post, apparently, and I just saw this article this morning.
I just went there. I just went there on my iPad to see it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Say what happens.
So you go to New York Post. It goes and it redirects you, and you get this thing that says New York Post at the top, but it's got a picture of an iPad app below it, and it says, "Thanks for coming. NewYorkPost.com editorial content is now only accessible on the iPad through New York Post app. If you're a current New York Post app subscriber, please visit the App Store and download the latest version to access NewYorkPost.com through the index. If you're not a current New York Post app user and would like to subscribe, please download from the App Store. Thank you."
Now, it's important to keep in mind that the app is a subscription app for access. It's $7 a month, I believe it is, for access to the New York Post through this app. Meanwhile, of course, the website is free.
Right.
People have talked about that. This kind of thing is quote unquote breaking the web, because the web, the whole original idea of it is that it's universally accessible. It should be the same no matter what device you're going to look at things with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we haven't been perfectly in that world in a long, long time. But this is sort of an egregious example of, you're going to make it that you can't even get to your website depending on, which browser you use? Now, of course,
right,
forms of this have been around for a long time. There were websites that only worked on Internet Explorer, things like that. But You know, this is sort of taking it to another level. This is saying, you know, yeah, we this was free, but like go buy our app. And it would still be free if you were logging in on a laptop. But because you're logging in on your mobile device, screw you, you know. And look, there are ways to get around this kind of stuff. And on a computer, you can fairly easily change your browser string to be whatever you want, so that you may be sitting on your Macintosh, but you can make it simulate you being on a Windows machine or whatever you want. Now, of course, this is slightly tech geeky stuff. Like, the regular Joe is never going to do this or figure it out. Right now, there's no easy way to do that on an iPhone or an iPad. Probably you can do it on jailbroken ones, but we've talked before about, you know, very few people are going to do that and their risks and blah, blah, blah. but, you know, there are people calling for Apple to, like, add features to basically pretend to be other things to counter this kind of stuff.
But I don't think that they probably don't want to get into a battle with their own app publishers.
Yeah, they probably don't mind that you go, because they get 30% of that $7 a month.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I think this is the kind of, this is all like, the publishers are increasingly desperate to find some way they can continue to make money and be profitable. And they're having a hell of a time doing it. And, yeah, so they're going to be trying stuff like this. I don't know that it'll work. I mean, like, you know, I'm not a New York Post reader, you know, but I can tell you,
neither am I.
If I got this kind of crap when I, like, let's say I had been a New York Post reader and I got this when I went to their website on my device, yeah, this wouldn't make me want to buy the damn app. This would make me incredibly
pissed. Not particularly,
pissed.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say not particularly, you know.
You know, and like with the New York Times, they don't need, they can afford to lose a lot of people as long as they get enough to reach some sort of, you know, equilibrium where they're making some money from it. You know, so they can lose lots of readers, but if they get enough, they're okay. I don't know. This is jackass stuff. I think that it's like, you know, this seems like continuing death throes of the old publishing industry. There are people who will figure out how to make good money in the new ecosystem and the new way of doing things, but these old players have no idea what the hell they're doing, no idea how to get out of this. And I don't know the answer either, but smart people will figure out ways to do interesting stuff. But these guys who've been around for a long time are stuck in the old ways, and very, very few of them are going to successfully make the transition, I think. Most of these newspaper, magazine, whatever, most of them are going out of business. I mean, it's just a matter of time. And there'll be a small handful that figure out how to make the transition and survive, and then you're going to have a whole bunch of brand new stuff that never existed before. And I think that's okay.
I mean, I think that, I mean, it's going to be, look, people are going to have to, those companies are going to have to figure out different things. And it's like, just like we were talking about technology and IBM, for example. It's like, it's the same thing. I think the people that get stuck just in trying to think, well, we sell newspapers, okay?
Yeah.
Instead of saying that we're a provider of information, okay? I mean, that's the problem. These fucking people are like stuck. I mean, the New York Times.
And by the way,
thing is like basically they just raised up a fucking banner outside their building that just says, "We just sell newspapers. We don't know anything else." Might as well.
Right. And I mean, this applies, you know, across the board. Yeah, I mean, the general advice you gave applies to any industry. But, you know, what we were just talking about newspapers and magazines, applies just as much to books, movies, music, you know, sure, television, all of this kind of stuff. You know, adapt or die, and most of them are going to die.
Yep.
Yeah, so.
I think my buddy downstairs, my buddy near my neighbor, is having a little bit of a problem with his barbecue because it just started pouring down as a thunderstorm.
Oh, nice. Oh, I can almost hear the rain. I could almost hear the rain.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say it exploded or something, but, you know.
Well, no. I was seeing smoke, like gobs of smoke pouring across my window. I was getting worried there was a fire outside or something, but no, I realized it was just a barbecue. So.
Okay, on that note, let's take another break, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about inflation, the housing market, the economy, blah, 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 that kind of lovely stuff. We'll be back after this.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah. And we're here. So I guess let me start with a personal note. We just noticed in the last couple weeks, because we were just, you know, by whim, looked at a couple things and realized that here in Seattle, in this Seattle metropolitan area, I guess.
Housing has gotten cheap.
Not cheap. It is not cheap. But
affordable.
It has dropped enough so that it is in the realm where we could potentially get something comparable to the place we're renting for about the same as we're renting, or maybe even a little bit less.
Okay.
And so it's like, oh. Yeah, because ever since we've been here, we've been in the mindset of like, you know, Seattle's still way too expensive, we're just going to rent, blah, 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 blah. Now, you do, in order for what I said to be true, have to be a little further away from the city than we are right now. But there's stuff coming into play that is within the realm of possibility. So we're like, you know, I don't 100% know that this is the right time to think about, the right time to actually buy, but it is probably time that we should start paying attention and start thinking about it and start looking at what's on the market and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe something will come up, maybe something won't, maybe something will make sense, maybe it won't. But it's got, and in a lot of places, it looks like things may have bottomed and might be starting to crawl slightly back up. You know, this is highly dependent on, like, the neighborhood and stuff. Some other neighborhoods look like they're still going down. But It's interesting. Like, are we at a turning? And this, what I'm saying here, of course, is different in every city and every locale. Like, this isn't a national thing. So, you know, what I'm saying about the Seattle suburbs we're looking at may completely not be true somewhere else. But it looks like that might be starting to happen, and it looks like the prices are now low enough that we can, like, contemplate it. So we're starting to pay attention again. And so I just found that interesting. And who knows, it may mean we end up buying a house in a few months, or not.
Well, I will tell you this. People that have been asking me that question, okay, whether, you know, about the real estate market, my answer has been the time to buy is now.
Yeah.
Okay? There is no better time to buy. That is my personal opinion. I think that one of the things that you keep reading in the newspapers and you keep reading, well, housing is still collapsing, housing is still collapsing, and I'm like, they, because they're looking at this index that is a backwards-looking index, okay? And let me explain why. They keep talking about Case-Shiller.
Yeah, Case-Shiller.
Case-Shiller, they keep talking about that. The problem is that Case-Shiller measures current transactions, and it doesn't measure market value drops. So to give you an example, it could be, for example, that the market value of the properties in your neighborhood 2 years ago already dropped by 50%. However, what happened
was
a lot of people were reluctant.
Yeah.
Exactly. So no transactions were happening at that price that already had dropped by 50%. What's happening now is that people have finally decided to say, fuck it, we're going to sell. other people's side has said, fuck it, we're going to buy. The transaction is happening, and that price had actually already dropped two years ago.
The other part of what it is I'd say, like, of what we've been looking at, like, probably 70, well, I won't hazard a percentage, but a significant fraction are either bank-owned at this point or are short sales.
So this is still,
you know, a lot of distressed stuff that, like, yeah, these are, you know, people who got foreclosed on, they couldn't keep up, whatever, and now the bank is just trying to dump it. You know,
right?
But the bank but the bank's not willing to go to the bottom either. They're also reluctant to go too low. So, you know, it drops, but it's not like you're getting houses for, like, you know, ten grand or something.
Well, no, you're not going to get 10 grand, obviously, but you're going to get you're going to get a reasonable deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You're going to get something. I mean, you're going to get something that's close to what the market value of the property is right now. And bottom line is that I think it's a moment that one of the things that was shown was the housing affordability index right now shows that it's gotten back to a point where it's that buying in many instances right now is starting to become cheaper than renting.
Yeah.
Okay. Because and rents have been going up.
And that's the math we were doing. It's like, you know, basically, hey, wait a second. You mean we could get a mortgage for that amount of money and pay less than we're paying rent right now? What the fuck?
That's exactly right.
Why aren't we looking at it, you know?
And because for a while, that relationship was not there. And, like, right now, it's getting to a point where we're buying it. It has become, in many instances, either the same or cheaper than renting. And that's why
–
that took a long time to happen.
I'll add, it looks, at least here in this area, it looks like buyers are still somewhat sparse and reluctant as well. Because, like, when you look, some of these houses have been on the market a long time, even at what look like more reasonable prices.
One of the things that I was seeing is that apparently, for some reason, Seattle had been and I was looking at different markets and, like, what's been happening around the U.S. And I saw that Seattle, for one reason, this had been happening later in Seattle than in other parts of the country.
That's
I will
true.
Tell you this, that over here, buyers have been – I mean, I've never buying is up.
Right.
Way up. I mean, I'm seeing transactions happen all the time. I will tell you that in our condo over here where I'm on the board – we had more transactions in the last 12 months than we had in the previous 3 years combined.
Right.
Okay. I mean, we're having transactions close every month. And so, you know, at prices that, by the way, are 50% off from the bottom.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's definitely something that is significant. And so that's why I'm saying to people, I'm like, I'm seeing that kind of activity. Then I'm like, I think it's the time to buy. You know, Miami condo market, which is always the poster child for disaster, right? Right now, downtown Miami occupied 80 plus 90%. I was down there on Friday afternoon. Happy hour after I got out from the office, and I hadn't been down there in a while for a couple of reasons. Like around that time, I've been there for dinner or some other stuff at some other times, but just not been there to the usual hangouts that I used to go out there. I mean, it was like bustling with people.
Mm.
Bustling. I mean, bustling with people. I was like, oh my God, where'd all these people come from? I mean, 2.5 years ago, you came down here, it looked like a freaking ghost town. Okay? And now it was just absolutely bustling with people. So, definitely that's seeing a recovery like far faster than people ever thought it would. And I'm seeing a lot of pickup in activity. I'm seeing a lot of people in buying. You're seeing pickup in people for mortgages. But even if that's it's a good thing that I don't think the market has just got a lot more downside for it to go. It's just a good moment to find a property you like, make a good offer, and you're not gonna be in a difficult situation. Just research where you're going. There, like we said, there are certain neighborhoods that are in a death spiral. Okay, for certain reasons. Okay,
right.
Specific area reasons. Okay, you get places that were recent developments that maybe 80% of properties were speculators, and they were in the middle of fucking nowhere, and still nobody's buying. Well, dude, if nobody's still if still 80% of houses are empty, dude, that is not a place you want to go into. That is just not a place you want to go into. You know, but there are certainly a lot of other places that have much better, you know, demographics and circumstances of people owning around and whatever, and that maybe the market got a little bit hurt because of a short-term situation in the general market, but right now those places are not hurting anymore. And, you know, you should be able to get a good deal on a house and not be worried about the price collapsing. I'll tell you, I talked to Sam about this a little bit because one of the things that I have advocated over the last 2 years is that in order to solve this problem, like overall with the housing and everything, I said 2 years ago, and I'll say it again, and somebody in the Wall Street Journal put it in the cover today, what this country needs is a good fucking 5% inflation. That's what we need. We need 5% inflation. It's just, I think, you know why? Because, like, right now, even still today, with the lowering with people going, you know, short selling, foreclosures, even though debt is down, personal debt is down about 4% from its peak. Okay, it's still not down enough, and the only way to get and there's still you've got about a little over 20% of people that have houses that owe more than they're worth. So The only way out of it is by having fucking inflation. Debts remain the same. People's earnings go up. Value of assets goes up. You know, yes, some people will get hurt in inflation, especially people that are savers and some people. But damn it, you know what? They're showing a chart that the Great Depression, okay, when it really ended was when inflation actually finally took off, okay? And I think – I've been saying this the same thing, that if we get – okay? And it was a period from 1940 to 1948 when consumer prices rocketed 70%. Fuck it. Give me some – God damn inflation! And I'm telling you, you know, this things will be better. That's what I think. And there's a couple of factors that may help us with the inflation. One is the fact that inflation is surging in China. And if we get inflation in China, that's going to mean that a lot of the products and inputs that we get into our economy, the prices are going to go up. So there's no any other way that the that our pricing goes up. But then at the same time, it's going to make it that well. Sending all that shit down to make in China. Maybe it's not that affordable anymore. Maybe you should make it here, and that's gonna push like for some of that. So you're gonna get that's gonna have an effect at some point. You know, it's not gonna be immediate, but I think that if you know, in the next, you know, right now the last inflation measure said we're at 3.6%. If we keep going at that 3.6 to 5%, I think that will help us get the fuck out of this thing. We definitely don't want deflation. That's what Japan had over the last 20 years, and they're still miserable. They still are not out of a fucking crisis 20 years ago. So, go inflation, baby. That's my new slogan.
But how about we just do it faster and go for, like, you know, 100% inflation or something? No?
Well, that's a problem. Now, yeah, that creates a whole host of other problems.
Well,
it could be too much of everything.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard people lament a few times is that the Fed theoretically is supposed to, like, try to hit some sort of inflation target, but they won't say what it is.
Right.
And just say, okay, we're going to try for 5%, see what happens. Of course, I can understand the reluctance to do so when they set a target and then they don't, you know.
They don't
the economy doesn't actually cooperate, but, you know, shows right. Just how little they actually control.
Now, anyway. The European Central Bank actually has, as a one of its mandates, an inflation target. Yes, which
and
is
they publish
2%.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, it's 2%. Okay.
Anyway. Interesting stuff, I guess. I don't know. But the economy does seem to be doing better. I know there are a lot of, you know,
Everybody I talk to in business say it's telling me we're having more orders, we're having more business, we're having more activity.
Well,
I keep getting all these gloom and doom in the news about stuff, but
the core difference to this is the core difference that people always get confused on. The quote unquote recession ended a long time ago because the recession
right.
is the time of negative growth. But then people
right.
measure when they think of when do we match the previous peaks, which is different. We are now growing again. We have been for a while. And that means that, you know, the recession is over, has been a long time, but people won't feel like things are good again, quote unquote good again, until they feel like they're better than they were at the previous peak.
Oh, well, fuck. Well, I hate to break the, you know, can I break the news to people? That ain't happening anytime soon.
But I mean, that's the fundamental psychological disconnect. I mean, economists worry about, are we growing or declining? The regular people on the street are worrying about, am I better than I was at, you know, last time I peaked? I want to be better than I ever was before. And until that's true, I'm not happy.
I want to get laid like when I was like 25 years old. People, it ain't happening again.
Well, you know, on that cheery note,
break the news to you. you know?
Well, so. I mean, the way patterns go, you know, eventually, you know, the whole economy will be back to its previous peaks. Although you have to keep in, once you account for inflation and stuff, you know, the previous peak is a long, long time ago. It's not like this right before the crash in 2007 or whatever. We're talking
peak,
back
you know,
to 2001 or
not,
even earlier.
But just because the economy may be back to that peak, that doesn't mean that you are going to be back at your peak.
That's absolutely true. It means other people
that were below you get ahead, maybe whatever. But sometimes, you know, one of the things that happens about life is that you get – I mean, you know, you've seen – you know, you go through ebbs and flows. I'm not saying that you can't get back there. But what I'm saying is that, you know, just don't hold – I mean, look. If you're fine and you're doing okay, you know, sometimes, I mean, some people got to, I mean, I met some people that were making just ridiculous amounts of money in that stupid economy just out of sheer luck, for God's sakes. You know, what I'm saying is that, you know, I know somebody that I met, they said, yeah, made $1 million selling real estate in 2006. Mm. I got to tell you something.
That ain't
you know,
good.
Yeah, that I'm telling you, given your skill set and what you've got opportunities in front of you, I think that that may not be happening again in anytime soon.
Right. Well, I look at it, I've mentioned this before, I've gotten damn lucky on, you know, stock grants at my current company. I would not be surprised in the slightest, you know, if 2010 was my peak year for income in my entire lifetime, you know?
I understand. It's like the same thing. Like, for example, I mean, I got look, I got very lucky and I bought Apple in fucking 1998, for God's sakes. I'm like, I'm not holding out my breath and I'm going to buy again the fucking number one stock that performed over the fucking decade of 2000. OK, I really honestly, I don't think I'm going to hit that twice.
Right.
I would like to, but I don't think I'm going to.
You'll work on hitting the Mega Millions or something instead next time.
Hey, what the hell? I do buy the lotto. What the fuck? You know, you know. Hey, who knows?
Okay.
Hey.
Anyway, I think
right,
we have a show here.
Note.
Thanks everybody right. for joining us. That's another episode of Curmudgeon's Corner, done and complete. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com with questions, comments, thoughts. Tell your friends to listen and tune in next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.